I'm going to read Matthew chapter 2, verses 1 through 2, and then we'll go down to verse 11. I'm not going to read the whole thing because John just read it to us. But in verse 1, it says, "After Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea in the days of Herod the king, behold, wise men," or magi, as it says in the Greek text, "from the east came to Jerusalem, saying, 'Where is he who has been born king of the Jews? For we saw his star when it rose,'" or "in the east, and have come to worship him." And that's exactly what they did when they found the child, not in Jerusalem, but in Bethlehem. They worshipped him. Verse 11 says, "Going into the house, they saw the child with Mary and his mother and fell down." That's a verb of worship in the scripture. They fell down and worshipped him. I think that of all the characters who appear in the Christmas story, the magi, the wise men, are the most mysterious. And in order for us to appreciate really what's going on here, because Matthew is writing primarily to Jews, to Israelites. And how do the Israelites feel about Gentiles? They use the word dog to describe them. You see that reflected in the scriptures. You're in big trouble and maybe excommunicated from the synagogue if you even go into a Gentile's house. It's that bad. And so when we hear the story of the wise men, we're like, yeah, and that's part of our Christmas story. We're Gentiles, right? But we don't think about the tension that's automatically here as Matthew, a Jew, is writing primarily to his people to tell them about their Messiah. And so we have to appreciate a little bit the history, the background behind the wise men. If you read most modern translations, they're called magi after the Greek text. And if you look at the word magi, M-A-G-I, that reminds you of a particular word. It reminds you of the word magic. Magic and magi are related terms. Some traditions think of them as kings, but they were not kings in the royal sense. They probably served in the king's court as magicians, not musicians, but magicians. And that's what they were thought of. They're regarded by most scholars as ancient Babylonian or Persian or Median priests who did magic in the king's courts. You remember reading the book of Daniel when Nebuchadnezzar dreams a troubling dream. What does he do? He sends for his wise men, the people that should be able to tell him what the dream means. And they're going to do it. They're going to work their magic. And the king's on to them and says, no. You tell me the dream and tell me the interpretation or I'm going to destroy you all. Remember that? These are the kinds of people that he's calling into his court. They were men who tried to interpret events on the earth based on dreams or sometimes the movements in the heavens. They were astrologers. They interpreted what was about to happen on earth based on what was going on in the heavens. Many of them also practiced sorcery and performed magic spells and incantations. And because of this, they were all thought of as possessing this secret knowledge because they could predict the future. They could interpret dreams. And we've come to assume many things about them throughout the stories as we tell the wise men story year after year. We've come to assume, I'm just saying in general, if you look at the magi in pop culture, okay, that there are three of them. Why? Because there are three gifts, gold, frankincense, and myrrh. But this idea of three has pervaded in the Western church for centuries. In fact, there's a tradition that goes back to where we actually know the names of the three wise men, Gaspar, Melchior, and Balthasar. All right, but those aren't in the Bible. If you thought they were, they're not. Okay, this is the tradition that's connected to the Christmas story. The Bible doesn't say how many came to Bethlehem. In fact, ancient paintings of the Magi show as few as two coming, and as many as eight coming to worship the Christ child. We also don't really know where to place the wise men, because we know it's a long journey, right? And a lot of people say they sort of start the timer at Jesus' birth, and they figure, you know, wise men will take like a year to get there, right? And so, and another thing is that in Matthew 2:11, it says that they came to the house where the young child lay. That's oikia, and it means a dwelling place. Well, obviously, Mary and Joseph probably didn't hang around in the stable, right? They got to some place as soon as they could with the newborn baby. But nevertheless, there's debate about when the wise men arrived. And some families I've known have been really, really over the top with this. They have a manger scene. It's a beautiful manger scene, but they have the wise men in another room, you know, because they say they're traveling there and they're not going to get to Bethlehem until later on. Personally, I feel they arrived on the scene pretty quickly. And the Bible doesn't say when the star appeared. It might have appeared in advance. It might have appeared maybe 9 months before Jesus Christ was born, and they followed the star and arrived at just the right time. We also imagine them coming all the way from the east to Bethlehem or to Jerusalem, being led by the star. But we know that can't be true because they came to Jerusalem. They saw a sign in the heavens, and they interpreted it somehow as a king being born in this region. And so they go to where they would think a king would be born. Where would you think? In the capital, Jerusalem. And then when they leave Herod, notice in Matthew's gospel there, it says, when they saw the star, they rejoiced with exceeding great joy. Why? Because the star hadn't necessarily led them step by step to Jerusalem. They were like, there it is again. And in this case, I think it was at least in this case, a supernatural event where God puts the star there and leads them right to Bethlehem where the baby was. These are pagans coming across the wild to worship the Christ child. Whatever the wise men, these stargazers saw, they discerned that it was announcing the birth of the King of the Jews. So they came and rejoiced at the coming of this child. Now, how did these magi know to look for this great King of the Jews? The only thing we know is that when the Jews left Persia to return to their homeland to rebuild Jerusalem after the exile, there were a multitude of them who stayed behind in Babylon and Persia. There was a huge Jewish community. Where these wise men come from. And of course, Daniel had been there. And Daniel had taught. And so that's the only thing we can think of is maybe they picked up on this through the Jews that were living in their homeland. They may have discerned it from the Old Testament scriptures. Many Bible scholars see a reference to the star in the book of Numbers. It appears in the fourth prophecy of Balaam. Have you looked at this before? In Numbers chapter 24, when Balaam blesses rather than curses God's people, remember Balak wants him to curse the people of God, and Balaam can only bless the people of God because God will not let his lips utter curses against his people. And in Numbers 24, verse 17, Balaam declares, "A star shall rise out of Jacob." And there's something unique about the story of Balaam with reference to the journey of the wise men. Balaam was the high priest of Midian, who was believed to have special abilities. And these abilities that Balaam had were very similar to what we would think the wise men would have had. Balak, the king of Moab, was fearful of Israel's rise to power, and so he asked Balaam to curse them. Balaam makes a special journey to God's people. And instead of cursing them, he ends up blessing them. And so you have a hateful king who feels threatened, and you have a magi-like figure from the east who recognizes God's blessing on Israel. And more than 1,400 years later, the wise men make a similar journey to bless the ultimate descendant of God's people, the Messiah. Representatives from one country were often dispatched to honor the new king of another land. And it was common in the ancient east to do this. And whether the wise men understood the full significance of this particular king or not is lost on us. We have no idea what they were thinking. One way or another, these men were led to Bethlehem to bow before a foreign king, Jesus, the Messiah of his people, the Savior of the world, who will one day rule the world. So what's the significance of these men? What does it mean that pagans are worshiping the Christ child? The coming of the wise men to worship Christ serves to contrast the hatred and disinterest for Christ on the part of the Jewish royalty and the religious elite. Did you see that in the story? Herod, who hates Jesus, and the priests who are asked to interpret why the wise men are here. And it's just a brief journey to Bethlehem, and they don't want to bother making the journey. Herod is the self-made king of the Jews who should have given Jesus a royal welcome. The high priests and scribes were the top religious officials in the Jewish religion who should have been overjoyed. Wait a minute, Messiah has come? and rush themselves to Bethlehem. Instead, they don't even have enough interest to go and check it out for themselves. Instead, by contrast, pagan priests are bowing down before him. The lesson here is for us who ought to be worshiping Christ, but are not. That has to be Matthew's main thrust here. As we read the text, we're forced to identify with those outside Jewish people, those people outside of the Jewish covenant, rather than God's people. When a story is told, you know this, right? You identify with the protagonist, the guy in the story or the girl in the story who's the main character, who has this mission to accomplish, and things get in the character's way, and finally they overcome it. And if it's an interesting story, it has an interesting plot and different obstacles that have to be overcome. And finally, the climax is when the person who's the main character in the story achieves the goal, or maybe gets defeated in the goal. That's called a tragedy. But nevertheless, this is how stories work. And so you find yourself going through a story. If there's multiple characters, sometimes you focus in on one, and you sort of are living out the story as if you're that character. This is what we do when we engage in literature. And there's so many wonderful narratives in Scripture, and most of them we're identifying with God's people and the obstacles that are in their way, and the fact that God is bringing them through this trial. Moses, for instance, leading the people across the Red Sea, or through the wilderness, or David facing Goliath. We read that story. We're standing there facing that giant. Who is Matthew asking us to identify with here? Not Herod. No. Not the priests. They don't have concern. We are identifying with these pagan kings. That's what Matthew tells the story about. There came wise men from the east, he says. And so there's a sting in this story. What is our interest in the Christ child? If the pagans can come, what about us who know the Son? Or at least we claim to know him. And that sting, I think, is especially rife in the lives of the people of Israel who read Matthew's gospel, who did not accept Christ as their Messiah. Matthew, of course, as I said, is writing to primarily a Jewish audience, and he wants to prove to these Jewish people that their Messiah came and they missed him. And to intensify his point, he contrasts the sinful attitudes of Herod and the priests and the scribes with the reverential attitudes of the Gentiles. These were the kind of men who had been Daniel's enemies in Babylon. These were considered to be outside of God's purposes. They are ones that God is not saving. He's just saving the Jews, Matthew's people that he's writing to probably would have thought of. And yet Matthew brings them to worship the Messiah. In fact, Matthew does this often in his gospel. He will take the ones that should be following the Messiah and marginalize them and exalt somebody who's lowly, somebody whom Christ came to save. He selects his disciples, Jesus does, from the poor class. And Matthew himself is from one of the worst hated classes. He's a tax collector, right? He's a publican. The word publican and sinners are used together to speak of the worst kind of sinners in the gospels. Matthew was one of them. He wasn't a high-born, elite class. Throughout his ministry in Matthew's gospel, we see Jesus eating with publicans and sinners. It's not to a Jew, but to a Roman centurion that Jesus declares in Matthew 8:10, "I have not found such a great faith, no, not in all of Israel." Remember that? He says that about a Roman centurion. That is a slap in the face of a Jew. It's a sting. And on that occasion, Jesus says, "I say to you that many will come from the east and the west and sit down with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the kingdom of heaven. But the sons of the kingdom will be cast out into outer darkness. There will be weeping and gnashing of teeth." Jesus says, from all over the nations, they'll come to worship the Son. But his own people reject him. In Jesus' parable, the Pharisee prays to be seen of men, and the publican prays for forgiveness. And Jesus says, this man went down to his house justified rather than the other. Continually in his ministry, Jesus is rejected by the scholars and the kings and the religious men, but he's welcomed by open arms from the poor and needy and the rejected and the foreigners. And rightly did Jesus apply the words of the prophet Isaiah to himself. He said, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me because he has anointed me to preach the gospel to the poor. He has sent me to heal the brokenhearted, to proclaim liberty to the captives, to recover the sight of the blind, to set at liberty those who are oppressed." Listen, we think of the wise men. We don't think of them as being in that class because they're kings, we think of them as. Or they're from royal courts. They're coming across the desert. They've got resources. They bring gold and frankincense and myrrh. They have these rich gifts. So we think of them up here as these wonderful people, and they help sort of color the story a little better. Because, you know, shepherds, you know, they're kind of smelly. They're out in the fields. In fact, the Jews thought shepherds were thieves. They were just out all the time without being able to bathe. All kinds of things that they did to look down on shepherds in that culture. And it's a wonderful thing that the angels actually appear to shepherds and welcome shepherds. And we can see that Jesus has come to the poor when we see the shepherds, but not the wise men. What I want you to understand is in the mind of the Jew, these pagans are just as terrible to them as the shepherds would have been. There's nobody high-born that pays attention when Jesus comes into the world. And so it is this wonderful mystery and lesson for us that the wise men come, of all people, to worship Christ. I look at the story under these three subordinate points, and I borrow this outline from my pastor in Minneapolis, Dr. Doug McLaughlin. Some of you were here when he was in the area, and I asked him to come preach. And this is one of his outlines I took down years ago, and I've always remembered it whenever I've come to this text, and it focuses our attention on the people where Matthew is drawing our attention to. So there are three different responses that you see to the child here. First of all, there's the response of Herod. What did Herod do? Herod, my pastor in Minnesota would say, Herod abhorred him. He abhorred him. He hated him. Herod is a power-hungry tyrant who would do anything to secure his throne. He was ruthless, he was evil, he was dangerous. I talked about Herod last week. I don't want to go over all the terrible things that he did again, but I want you to think about it. These strange visitors show up asking about the birth of the King of the Jews. And a sign in heaven revealed it to them. And celestial signs were taken seriously in Herod's day. It was believed that by the birth or death of great men, there was always an announcement by the stars. In fact, in some countries, wise men such as these had the power to elect kings to say who was supposed to be the next guy on the throne because their word was trusted. They would say they saw it in the heavens and they would follow their advice. Legend has it that Alexander the Great's rise to prominence was foretold by the appearance of what was later known as Halley's Comet. There was enough superstition in the ancient world that should word get out that a true king had been born, the people of Jerusalem would have gladly revolted and overthrown Herod. So notice verse 3 of your text in Matthew 2. When Herod the king heard this, he was troubled, and all Jerusalem with him. When Herod was upset, the people were upset, because they braced themselves, wondering what the next example of Herod's wrath was going to be. In Herod's mind, no one was going to touch his throne. So in the course of the events that followed, Herod tried to lure the Magi back to him with news of where to find this baby king. Verse 7 says, he summoned the wise men secretly and ascertained for them the time the star had appeared. And he sent them to Bethlehem, saying, go and search diligently for the child. And when you have found him, bring me word that I too may come to worship him. Yeah, we really believe that. And this might have worked had the Lord not warned the Magi in verse 12 not to go back to Herod. Herod abhorred him. I don't know that we have anybody here that actually abhors the Lord. I mean, why would you even be here? You know, when we go out into the world and even spending time with some family where God places us, we will run into people who just hate the gospel. They don't want to listen to it. They don't want to hear about Christ. They're bitter for some reason. Maybe something happened in the past. Maybe they just have vowed that they're not going to come to the Lord. Maybe the Lord has convicted them and they hate that conviction. And if you will hold forth the light of the gospel of Christ, there will always be a reaction when godliness invades ungodliness, when light invades darkness. And here come these Magi talking about a light born into the world. And this is the reaction. And we need to be prepared, Jesus says, for that reaction. Herod abhorred him. But the priests and the scribes have a different attitude. They don't abhor him. What my pastor in Minnesota would say is that the priests and scribes ignored him. They ignored him. Magi from the east show up in a royal palace seeking for a newborn king. A king like the Messiah. No Messiah born here. But wait a minute. They got together the chief priests and the scribes and they asked, Herod asked of them where the Christ, where the Messiah should be born. When you see that word Christ, of course, it's Messiah. And the priests and the scribes knew their scriptures. The star they had seen when they were in the east was just a sign in the heavens signaling the birth of the king of Judea. And the Magi had come seeking a king in the most obvious place. But the priests and the scribes said, no, it's in Bethlehem. Because that's what it says in Micah 5:2. In Bethlehem of Judea, verse 5. For it is written by the prophet, and you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means the least among the rulers of Judah. I mean, you're in a little tiny town. I was at Bethlehem this summer. A lot of you know that. Bethlehem is not the little town of Bethlehem anymore. It's a pretty big city, but it's got all these hills, and you can see where the shepherds would have been out on the hills. But at that time, it was just a very tiny town. And the prophecy says, you're not little at all, because out of you will come a ruler who will shepherd my people, Israel. These religious leaders knew where the Messiah was to be born, but they did not join the Magi in their quest. I mean, they're 6 miles away, literally, 6 miles away. A road led south out of Jerusalem that would have taken them by camel or donkey on a brief journey, but they were complacent, apathetic, comfortable, and they couldn't be bothered. And it is ironic that these are some of the same priests and scribes, no doubt, who later would seek to kill Jesus, just like Herod did. The priests and scribes ignored him. I hope we don't ignore him. That really is the thing that we are guilty of. Because we get so busy and we can go through days and weeks and really not focus our attention on him. But the final attitude in the text starts in verse 9. After listening to the king, they went on their way, and behold, the star they had seen when it rose before them, went before them until it came to rest over the place where the child was. When they saw the star, they rejoiced exceedingly with great joy. And going into the house, they saw the child with Mary, his mother, and they fell down and worshipped him. Then opening their treasures, they offered him gifts, gold and frankincense and myrrh. Herod abhorred him. The priests and scribes ignored him. But the wise men adored him. The word worship is used 3 times in this passage, and it serves to highlight Matthew's point. If those to whom Jesus was sent will not worship him, the Gentiles will worship him. When they saw Jesus, they fell down and worshiped him. And this posture was not unusual in the worship of a king, but Matthew seems to imply something more here. When Eastern peoples bowed before their kings, they worshiped them as gods. And here the wise men were worshiping the Son of God. So when it says they fell down, this posture is really interesting that Matthew includes this. It's an attitude that was appropriate for worshiping the Son of God. And they offer gifts that are fitting for a king. Gold, of course, was a kingly gift. Frankincense and myrrh were often used in royal courts. These costly gifts demonstrate the sincerity and earnestness of their worship. And the coming of the wise men to worship the Christ child serves to contrast the hatred and disinterest for Christ on the part of the Jewish royalty and the religious elite. Herod was the self-made king of the Jews who should have given Jesus, like I said, the royal welcome. And the priests and scribes ignore him, but these pagan priests honor him and bow down to him. So the lesson here is for those of us who ought to be worshiping Christ, but are not. And we need to identify with these pagan priests. I don't know that we abhor him, but we do ignore him. And Christmas reminds us of that. You know, I often hear this at Christmas. I've probably stated it myself. You know, Christmas gets really busy. We have all these parties. We have these gifts and we have the lights and everything's sort of crowding out Christ from our mind. Everything competes for our attention. And we do all these things in the name of Christ. We decorate. We have programs. We go to parties. We do this in the name of Christianity, or if not the name of Christ. But he can go unnoticed. like a child sitting unnoticed in the corner at his own birthday party when other people in the room are having fun and opening gifts. But in our world, driven by consumerism, a king can be born and we don't notice because of everything else that's going on. It's like Christmas all the time in our world, in this commercial world, isn't it? We have everything we could imagine all the time, and we have sales going on all the time, and people pushing us to buy things all of the time. And so it's not just at Christmas that we can be distracted. It's all of the time that we can be distracted. And so at Christmas time, we might even focus more attention on Christ than normally during the year because he's being talked about perhaps more often at more events that we go to. But then we sort of drift back into our normal routine and we don't think of him most of the time. It's very easy for religious people like us to ignore Christ, to take him for granted, to do things for him and about him without really paying attention to him. Everything we're doing at Christmas is for him, but to spend some quality time in the Word, in prayer, in fellowship with him, actually adoring him, that's what the Lord wants from us, both at Christmas and the rest of that year. So like those priests and scribes in Matthew's account, we're so close. We have all this opportunity. Let's take the opportunity to adore him as the wise men adored him. The text calls us to have this worshipful attitude of the Magi. So as the song says, "Oh, come, let us adore him, Christ our Lord."